This week's episode of Amateur Traveler is sponsored by Expedition Unknown. Do you know that there's proof that Robin Hood might have been a real person using underground passageways under England to rob the rich? Or that gold coins discovered on the beaches of Florida might be connected to a Spanish treasure fleet that sank in 1715? On the Expedition Unknown podcast from Discovery, Josh Gates travels the world to investigate history's greatest unsolved mysteries. He'll take you through Russia and Germany looking for stolen objects of great value pillaged by Nazis during World War II, to Nepal to uncover mysterious caves high up the mountains, or to Peru to uncover the meaning behind giant geoglyphs drawn into the earth hundreds of years ago. I met Josh and interviewed him on This Week in Travel. Now it's been 12 years ago. Can't believe it's been that long, but that tells you how long he has been out there looking for stories like he's sharing on the Expedition Unknown podcast. Travel the globe with Josh Gates as he investigates some of humanity's greatest feats and most iconic legends. Listen to Expedition Unknown where you get your podcasts. And thanks to Expedition Unknown for sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you've listened to the show for any length of time, you know that I'm a big fan of connecting with locals when you're traveling someplace. If you're just going to be inside the tour bus, then you might as well stay home. The best parts of travel for me are when you get out into the marketplace or into the cafe where you meet the locals and have a chance to interact. If you're also looking to experience this, then check out Explore Worldwide, whose local tour leaders will get you off the beaten track and into the heart of the adventure, helping you get past being a tourist, experiencing local culture, and finding places you would not find by yourself. And isn't that what travel is all about? If you're thinking about your next adventure, head to exploreworldwide.com to find out more. Hi, it's Chris from Amateur Traveler. This is not a new episode this week, but comes from the back catalog. I think you'll enjoy it. I'm taking a week off to travel, spend time with my family, and unfortunately have COVID. I got my bags packed on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo. Amateur Traveler, episode 781. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about temples and festivals, fishing boats and palaces, striped hyenas, and the Asiatic lion, as we go to Gujarat, India. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about Gujarat. I'd like to welcome back to the show James Schomburg, who has come back to the show to talk about Gujarat, India. James, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Chris. This is very different to the last two times I've come to speak. So.
Yeah, I said welcome back. I think you were on 5 minutes ago, as I recall.
It feels like that.
I almost never do this, bring somebody back right away, but James did such a great job and pitched me such interesting places that, you know, that's what happens. That's the danger of making a good pitch.
Oh, thank you.
And Gujarat was not a place that I could even have put on a map in India. Where are we talking about?
So it's in the far western, central to northern western border, bordering Pakistan. So Pakistan's its western border, and the southern border is the Arabian Sea. And the states that people probably do know a lot better that it attaches to are Rajasthan, and where a lot of people go for the first time as Indian visitors, and also Maharashtra, which is where Mumbai is the capital. So it's actually close to some of the big hitting states in terms of tourism. But it's very different geographically. It's very different feel to the rest of India. I've been to India 9 times to travel and teach, and it's got a very different feel to the other states, and it's quite unique, which makes it quite attractive for somebody.
Excellent. Well, why should someone go to Gujarat?
Well, I think for that reason too. Look, it's probably not the place you'd go to first time when you go to India. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I brought one of my good friends is also a lecturer at the university with me. I needed help. This was his first experience in India, and he went to Gujarat with me. He came away saying this was mind-blowing for him. So But it is a great place if you're looking for something different, if you're looking for something that's remote, if you're looking for something that is, you'll be certainly be treated like royalty because everybody will be looking at you bizarrely because they really see many tourists, except around where the lion sanctuary is. It's a place where it's just so different to the rest of India in terms of just lack of tourism. But I think in a way that adds to the beauty of it. The beauty of it is, I think for me, the wildlife. The wildlife was quite mind-blowing. And I know I've spoken to so many people in India, and a lot of people associate India with tigers, and rightly so. They're doing an incredible job with tigers. But what they have in Gujarat is lions, leopards, hyena, and wolf. So animals that people would be a bit surprised that perhaps are in India, but you get to see all of these in a very small area too. So its wildlife is stunning. The history there is absolutely amazing. It was the birthplace of Mahatma Gandhi. So it's also got a lot of history there with Gandhi in the north, which I didn't get to, but there's a lot of great history for anybody who's interested in the partition. The food is absolutely spectacular, very different to the rest of Indian food and festivals. We got experienced by chance a festival where we evenly counted the numbers where we're at with 1 million people were at this festival. And it certainly felt like it. So you've got history, food, festivals, and wildlife. It's really got a real mix in a very relatively small area with nowhere near as much traffic or craziness perhaps that a lot of people associate with India in other parts.
Excellent. Well, what kind of itinerary are you going to recommend for us?
So this is based on what I did. And as I said, I'll just preface it by saying we didn't head to the north or the far west of Gujarat where there's Ahmedabad, which is the capital of Gujarat and where Gandhi was born. And there's a lot of great places to visit there. There's also a place that I love the name called the Little Ran of Kutch. It sounds like something from Star Wars. It's a great name, and I've always wanted to visit it just to go to say I've been there, but it's supposed to be spectacular desert country and fantastic textiles in small villages. So if anybody who is a Gujarati listening to this, I apologize because it's just that I simply didn't get to those places, so obviously I can't talk about them. But what I did do was a six-day itinerary after I finished teaching in a little city called Bhavnagar, which is where we flew in, and I'll explain that. We then spent 6 days heading south, and it's a great little introduction to all those things I mentioned before. So how you get there first is we flew in to Mumbai, which obviously is one of the biggest cities in the world, let alone India. It's then a very short, it's on the Arabian Sea, India, and Bhavnagar's on the opposite side, like in a peninsula. Mm-hmm. And it was about a 40-minute flight, so not a long flight. So once you get off, you can then get a flight to Bhavnagar. Bhavnagar's, in Indian terms, a relatively small city. In Australian terms, it's one of our biggest. I think it's about 600,000 people who live there. And look, it's a very pretty little city. It really is a microcosm of all other cities in India. You wouldn't go to Bhavnagar particularly just to travel there, but it's a nice city once you fly in to spend the rest of the day there. We did stay, and it was incredibly well priced. We stayed in a palace called the Nilambagh Palace, which was the Maharashtra of Gujarat's, his current residence, but obviously his royal residence before partition when India was a series of different little independent states. The current Maharaja is still there. We met him. He's only in his mid-20s. He was working out in the gym and was introduced to us. He was a nice young guy, but it's quite cool. Half of the palace is now, because they're so large and so expensive to run, they've been converted to hotel rooms. And it was very well priced. I think it cost me about 80 Australian dollars, which would be all about 50, 60 US. To stay in a palace, a beautiful room with breakfast. And there were peacocks in the grounds. The gardens were beautiful. So it's quite a unique experience to live in the current Maharaja's palace with the Maharaja in a separate area. But he was quite open, happy to be out with people. You wouldn't know he was a Maharaja in the gym. He was just in gym gear, but it was a good experience. The great thing about Bhavnagar is that it's so well situated for a lot of sites. It's about 3 hours drive south of Ahmedabad. But we went the other way. We went south to the first spot that I'd highly recommend you visit is Palatana. Palatana is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The name of the area where the temples are in Palatana is called Shatrunjaya. It's one of Jainism's holiest pilgrim sites. And I probably should explain Jainism a little bit. I'm not a Jain, so I'm going to do it very badly. But Jain's one of the oldest religions on earth. It's still got a small foothold in India. Interestingly, speaking of a lot of Indians, a lot of the wealthiest Indians are Jains. Mm-hmm. And yet, to me, if somebody asked me, this is probably going to butcher it, it's somewhere between how I imagine Buddhism and Hinduism. It's got properties of both of them, and in fact a lot of Jain areas often have Hindu temples with it, and certainly Shatranjaya does. And what is it? It's a large hill. The hill's, I think it's a 500 meter climb, so it's about 1700 feet climb, and we're told it, and we were counting by the end, 3300 steps. It was a lot of steps to climb. Yeah, it's a lot of steps. It was a tough climb. But the whole time you're climbing, you're going past temples constantly until you get to the summit. And at the summit is its most famous temples. They are 900 years old, so very old. And they are holy because Adinath, who was the founder of Jainism, supposedly meditated under a tree up the summit there, and hence you've got these absolutely magnificent ornate temples at the top, which there was hardly anybody up there with us walking. We were able to wander through them freely. Absolutely beautiful, the temples themselves. But not only the temples fantastic, the view from the top of this mountain, because Gujarat is quite a flat state except for a couple of these peaks, which makes these temples even more prominent. But you could get a 360-degree view of the surrounds, and spectacular views as well. So the carvings up there were also just absolutely stunning. So that I would highly recommend for anybody who's got a level of fitness. If you haven't, but if you haven't, you can. Well, we did see it, because obviously for Jains being one of their most important sites, their holiest sites, a lot of people just simply can't climb these numbers of stairs. Mm-hmm. You can actually get carried up there like a king.
Oh, my.
Four people carry you like the Egyptian pharaohs. And we asked how much it would cost, not that we were going to do it, but I think it was only like $20 American to be taken up and down. Pretty tough work though. These four men, you could see even with the lightest people, that was hard work. And one person actually tipped out going down the stairs. So I don't know how safe it is. They didn't get hurt. It's definitely worth even going to the bottom of the temple and looking up at the temples, which are a long way up, 1,700 feet above you in terms of elevation. The mountain itself, I think, is about 2,500 feet. So you basically, there's a fair ascent that you have to do. But once you get up the top, it's well worth it. The next day, we drove further south to what I think was one of the most stunning places I've seen in my life, and that's Susan Gir National Park. And it's about a 5-hour drive, so it takes most of the day. And the driving's interesting, and I didn't mention driving. Do not drive. Do not drive in India, and I think you've been there. I hope you'd agree with me, Chris.
There was never a moment that I was tempted to. Well, I shouldn't actually say that that's the case. Way, way back in the archives on Amateur Traveler, you can find an episode we did on the Enduro India.
Oh, that's right.
Which was a long-distance motorcycle rally, not a race, on old World War II motorcycles through rural India. Wow. That's probably the only time that I thought that I was all tempted to drive in India was when we did that episode.
Yeah, well, I think other than that sounds like fun, but I tell you, with the roads, the quality of the roads, the traffic, the craziness of it all, it's an amazing experience, and I'd highly recommend for anybody who goes to India, firstly, to go by train somewhere, that's an experience. But secondly, don't just go by train. Get a driver to take you, because it's amazingly cheap. We got a driver from the first hotel. They'll arrange them for you. And he took us around all the rest of Gujarat. And I found that every time I've gone, the hotel will usually give you a good person who can speak English, which is really important in Gujarat. Unlike the other states, English is rarely spoken. They don't speak Hindi either. They speak their own language, Gujarati. So it is somewhere where it's very handy to have somebody who can speak a bit of English. And the car, the driver, the petrol, everything costs about $80 Australian, which is what, $50 American, $60 American a day. And splitting that between the two of us, my friend Jeremy and I, you know, that was very cheap, I think. And the driving, even though I said it was 5 hours to Gir, you're constantly going through villages and farmland, and there is just never a moment that you don't see something happening on the road. I've seen literally, and I think I said that to you when we spoke, I've literally seen a man on a motorbike drive with three goats draped over his legs towards the handlebars and one over around his neck while he's riding a motorbike. I've seen camels, I've seen elephants, I've seen ox carts. There is constantly something to look at. It never gets boring being on these small roads through India. And the villages are so full of colour that, to be honest, the driving to me was as much fun as the destination. But I'm so glad I wasn't the one driving. Ask for an air-conditioned vehicle too, because it might cost you an extra $5 a day, but it does get very hot, particularly in Gujarat. They call it desert, and where we were, I wouldn't have called it desert. It was much more like more of our outback, not our desert. I guess more like your Midwest. It was flat farming country. Mm-hmm. It certainly wasn't what I associate with our central deserts or the Mojave or something like that. It was much more lush than that. But when you get to Gir, Gir is down near the coast, and it's the last refuge of the Asiatic lion. I don't know, like I said, I've told so many people, saying there's no lions in India. They're only in
that
Africa.
Was my response, yeah.
Not just you, though, many people, but they're a completely different species. At one stage, there were only 20 left in the wild on Earth, and they were in this forest. But the Indian government have done such an amazing job that they've got the opposite issue now. I think there's something like 400 of these lions now in the park, and it's almost impossible not to see them. But the issue is now they've actually breached the space of the park because lions need a lot of space for their prides.
Right.
And they are spilling out into the public. Deaths are rare compared to tigers. And in fact, there's an amazing documentary with David Attenborough looking at how farmers are working with lions to help control the deer, which are eating their grass and so on. So it's amazing how they're working with them, but they are wild animals and they are big. They are lions. They are slightly smaller than the African lion, but they're still, otherwise they look identical. There's a bit of a tuft of fur on a hair on the back of their neck of the female lionesses, which is one way you can pick it up. But otherwise they look almost identical to the more traditional African lion, but they're completely a separate species. There is talk about bringing a whole lot of these lions into other parts of India where they used to be before they were wiped out by hunting.
Mm-hmm.
But the Gujarati people want to keep them there because they're great for their tourism. So there's a lot of toing and froing. But you can stay in many resorts around it. They call them resorts. They're beautiful places, very much like how I imagine a lot of African safari places would be, which are all around the park. The park is made out of dry teak. It's a dry teak woodland, hilly park. Beautiful in terms of forest, the sun setting. It does get very cold at night and in the morning, unlike most safaris, as I think you've done some in Africa too, that
sure.
You do need to get rugged up. It might be 25, 30 degrees, so 80 Fahrenheit in the daytime, but it gets close to zero in the morning. So do rug up when you go on those jeeps. But we saw, not only did we see lions, we saw lots of deer. We saw nilgai, which are the largest antelope in the world.
Oh.
They're as tall as an American bison and nearly as heavy. Not quite as heavy, but they are massive antelope. We also saw lots of crocodiles, mugger crocodiles, which are commonly seen in lots of the national parts of India. They do kill people. If that's why they call them mugger, but they're called mugger crocodiles. They are very squat and sturdy, but highly dangerous, evidently. But we saw them all on this trip. So we had a safari that night, and then we had a safari in the morning, and we'd seen all these beautiful wild animals both times. So to see lions was pretty special for us, and it was good to show people that they do exist outside of Africa. If I can recommend a place, there are many other lodges, but we stayed at a place called the Asiatic Lion Lodge. Highly recommend it. Beautiful park, separate accommodation. You sit outside and eat on a veranda where we're looking over a dam where we saw jackal come running in at night. So it was, you were seeing wildlife come straight to your park, straight to your lodge. Thankfully, we didn't see any lions in the lodge, but evidently they can wander through this area at times. So the third day, we did another safari, as I said, in the morning, and then we drove to a town called Junagadh. This was the place where we went on the, and it was unbeknownst to us until we got there. We'd come in at a time that was one of the holiest festivals in India called Bhavnath Mela. It's a Hindu festival. They have a million people, as I said, come to a small town of Junagadh, which is 300,000 people. They have a tented city, and it literally is a city of people. At the base of Girna Hill, which is the highest mountain in all of Gujarat, which is where Junagadh is based. It's at the base of it. Junagadh itself is a really nice city to visit. We didn't see a tourist, and the architecture is glorious there. You get all the temples. You have a lot of Muslim architecture as well. The Muslim architecture is quite spectacular, more from the 19th century, but you get so many different layers of history when you go to a town like Junagadh. But the absolute highlight was Girna Hill and the festival. We got a took into the start of the festival, and we realized how big it was. It was packed with people, everybody dressed in their best saris, in their best outfits. There was also a lot of people not dressed at all. They have a lot of nagas. They call them nagas, which are sacred sadhus. They're priests. And a lot of the priests were naked intentionally. It's quite a shock walking past and seeing a whole lot of naked priests trying to get you over to donate money. It was an interesting thing, not for the faint of heart at this festival, because not only you've got all these people, it's just millions, like I said, so many people thronging, climbing this mountain, which is 1,100 meters high. That's the highest in Gujarat. And I talked about 3,300 steps. This one had 10,000 steps. Now, we started it was 33 degrees, and about halfway up, 33, so that would be roughly about 90 Fahrenheit, I'm thinking. But we started to get overcome with the heat. So we'd seen enough, and we decided we could see all these temples on the top of the mountain, but we'd seen enough at this stage to not get there. It probably would have taken us another 2-3 hours to get to the top, and we still had to get down. But along the way, there was dancing, there was food everywhere, people selling food from the side of the steps. There were throngs of priests, there were people just singing, dancing. It was such a great celebration. It was such a positive energy. One of my most, I've seen a lot of festivals in India. There seems to be a festival for everything in India because they have so many different religions and they all enjoy each other's religions as well. They're not shy in celebrating Christmas, even if they're not Christians and so on, because if they like a good party, Indians. And so it was just such a good energy here that I think if you're brave enough to visit Junagadh during Bhavnath Mela, which is in March every year, it's well worth it. It's an experience you'll never forget. If you don't go that time of year, and it is a beautiful weather time too, it's usually very comfortable temperatures. But if you don't go that time, Junagadh is well worth visiting just to go at least halfway up Girna Hill. And also the other architecture. Some of the other places we visited that I'd highly recommend was Upakot Fort. And I had a look, I did do some research for me talking. This was built 319 BC, so it's extremely old, by the emperor who was Chandragupta.
Oh, sure.
Who was a Mauryan, I hope I said that right, Mauryan emperor. And he built this to be at the base of Girna Hill, and it was obviously a fort. It was being left fairly abandoned in the 15th century when it was taken over by Muslims coming over from the west, from Iran. It was left abandoned. In fact, they put a mosque in there, which is now in itself has been left abandoned. But you'll be walking through a mosque, then you'll be going through a fort, and there's also a 1,000-year-old Buddhist caves as well and stepwells. So you're getting Buddhist, you're getting Hindu, you're getting mosques. The mosque is the most recent, and that's 15th century. And the most amazing views are the Girna Hill and looking back over the city. It's on a slight rise, being a fort. Well worth it. And I think it cost us like $2-3 American dollars to visit. The other place that I'd say in Junagadh that's worth visiting is, and it's only a really quick stop, and you can do that on the way to the fort, is they call it the Vizier's Mausoleum. It was built in the late 19th century as a mausoleum for the Vizier who ran Gujarat at that stage. And it's these beautiful mausoleums with these minarets on 4 minarets and with these winding storybook minarets around the side, which are spiraling stairways around the sides, which are pretty amazing. So highly recommend that too. So that would be a very full day. So that's the end of day 3. Junagadh is a really nice town to stay in as well. And I've only just briefly mentioned the food before, but the food in Gujarat, a couple of points I'll make about Gujarati food. If you go to India, anywhere in India, you'll see Gujarati restaurants. It's that well known for its food. It's purely vegetarian. So for anybody who loves meat, they're going to see no meat for a week. However, I am a carnivore, but I will say that I could easily convert to vegetarianism in India, particularly in Gujarat. The vegetarian food is just absolutely amazing. There's all fresh vegetables. There's no alcohol either, which is, again, quite different to the rest of India. They're very devout Hindus there, and it's an alcohol-free state.
So that's really got to cut into their Australia tourism, I would think.
Well, I'll tell you a bit more about, we did go to another state further south, which I'll mention, and it was a breath of fresh air for Jeremy and I, who were traveling there with my business partner, because it does allow alcohol. So it was very nice. Two Aussies without alcohol for a week is tough going, but we got through it. But I will add that one of their specialities, which I just loved, I'm a sucker for a good milkshake, but Indian milkshakes are another level again. They did this one made with pistachios. It was basically pistachios and cashews. That's right. Pistachios and cashews that they basically ground down to make almost like a milky type milkshake, and then added it to a standard milkshake. But it was, they said, nearly all made out of the ground nuts. I love cashews and I love pistachios. So to have a milkshake that was, and it was almost like a thick shake. It was that thick. It was an absolutely brilliant drink, and I haven't seen it anywhere else in India. So if you get a chance, and you often get these great food places in dharbas, roadside dharbas, which are like middle of nowhere, you'll see these dharbas, and they're basically roadside restaurants.
Okay.
Very, very cheap for the truck drivers and for local travelers. They're everywhere. So one tip, though, is you need to pick a place that's busy, because there are so many, and if you are going to get Delhi belly, you're probably going to get it from a bad dharba where hygiene is poor. Conversely, the busy ones are busy for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very cheap food, and they have these fantastic milkshakes. And to be honest, it was nice not to have to worry about drinking beer for a change, instead having these milkshakes in Gujarat, especially their nut milkshakes, that were absolutely to die for. So we stayed in Junagadh for day four. We drove an hour and a half west to Somnath. Somnath is on the Arabian Sea, and it's another UNESCO World Heritage Site. They call it the Temple of the Sun. It's actually one of India's 12 Shiva Linga temples, Jyoti Linga temples. They're, lingas are devotional representations of Shiva, and they're shrines, and they're one of the 12, so it's a common pilgrimage site for Hindus to visit. It sits right in front of the beach. It's been destroyed over and over again. The history was, it was originally built in the 11th century, and it was destroyed by Afghan people who came, led by the Mahmud of Ghazai, destroyed it in the 11th century. It was then taken back by Hindus. Then it was destroyed again in 1297, 1304, and 1706 by Muslim rulers who came and marauded. Gujarat was right in the middle, unfortunately, where a lot of this happened. And each time, because it was of such significance to the Hindus, it was destroyed by the Muslim rulers of that time. So the newest incarnation is only 18th century. Parts of it were still kept from the 11th century where it was originally destroyed. It's a place that you, firstly, you can't take your camera in there. You can't even take your phone in there. Security, because it has been destroyed so many times, and because of its proximity to the Pakistan border, they're very sensitive about security there. Not that there was any trouble. I didn't feel nervous. But you have to leave your camera, your phone, and like a lot of temples, Jain temples and Hindu temples, any leather you're wearing has to be taken off.
Oh, sure. That makes sense.
Luckily, the milkshakes from Gujarat and the fattening vegetarian food, I didn't need a belt by this stage. My pants are being held up by my belly at this stage quite well. I didn't need to wear my leather belt, but it's well worth going into. The temple is absolutely spectacular inside. The ornateness of the carving of the stories of Shiva is mind-blowing, and I can see why it's such a famous site and absolutely beautiful. Again, you are likely to be the only tourists other than Indian tourists in this town, and it's well worth going for that reason alone. You really do feel like you're stepping into how India perhaps was 50 years ago with tourism. We then drove further down to another state. So Gujarat, at the bottom of Gujarat, is a very small state called Daman and Diu, D-I-U. Diu is actually, was up until the 1960s, was actually part of Portugal. It was actually a Portuguese colony. And sadly, there was a war between India and Portuguese, had a war that actually was on this small bit of land, which I didn't realize history was so recent. Now, it was a very one-sided war. Portugal lost very dramatically, and the Indians are very proud of that. But I think it was the last bit of land that was by one of the colonies. I think the other one was in the east where the French ruled Pondicherry, but that was given back to the Indians without war in the 40s, but it took a war to get Diu off the Portuguese. But the great thing about visiting it is you get this blend of Indian architecture and Portuguese architecture. Now, you see Portuguese architecture in lots of places in India, such as Goa,
sure,
which is another spectacular part of India, and also Mumbai. So Diu's great because it reminds me of how Goa, and I've been to Goa, would be if there was no tourism. It's got the beautiful golden sand beaches, just like Goa has. It has the beautiful coloured Portuguese homes. One home is bright red, then you go to a blue, then you've got a green. You could swear, if you just looked at the homes, that you could be in Lisbon or Porto. It's amazing the architecture that you're in India. But then you realise, when you get experience in other parts, that you've got old forts built by the Portuguese too, which have got a sort of a Indian and a Portuguese influence. So it's a really interesting mix. But the fort in Diu was built in 1535 by the Portuguese. It's fantastic to wander through. There are cannons still. There are beautiful ramparts with views over the ocean because it comes straight up off the ocean. There's old chapels, small chapels, which are in different states of decrepitness but remain beautiful. It's a fantastic spot to look at. It's been a stylish decay, is how I'd describe Diu. Walking through the town of Diu, you've got some fantastic churches that honestly you'd swear you're in Europe. There are a couple of cathedrals there which are 16th century. St. Paul's Church particularly was absolutely beautiful. It was founded by the Jesuits in 1600. And walking in there, you could swear you're in a Portuguese or Spanish cathedral. Beautiful architecture, very, very ornate. And then you walk outside and you're in India. It's quite shocking to the system to go from Europe to India in sort of in a few steps. But I think that's what excites me about going to Diu. The other thing that excited me about going to Diu was there was alcohol. And it's actually a federal state run through Delhi, and so it has none of the taxes like Goa. Goa and Diu are controlled by this federal government, and there's no tax for alcohol. So it made for anybody who was ready for a beer, as during an hour, it made alcohol very cheap. I mean, very, very cheap, because alcohol actually is not that cheap in India. Food and travel is very cheap, but alcohol was probably about the same price as I'd be paying here. But in Diu, I think it was about a dollar for a Kingfisher, which is your standard Indian beer. I'm not an alcoholic, just to say it was nice to have a beer in the hot tropical weather. Coupled with their seafood there, we had prawns there, which were cooked very spicily. That Portuguese influence really raises the chili factor. So we had some magnificent chili prawns there with beer, sitting by the beach watching the sunset. It was hard to beat. And again, you'll be the only tourists, and we were the only non-Indian tourists that we saw in that whole state. It's a very little state. You could drive across it in about 20, 30 minutes. So it's a very small state, but it's well worth visiting. We finished off the day before we watched the sunset, I should mention, and I would say if you go to Diu, besides Diu Town, which has that beautiful Portuguese architecture, the other place which is well worth visiting, and we loved it, is a little port village called Vanik Bara. Vanik Bara is, you have a small beach, but what you go there is the colourful boats that come in, the fishing boats, bringing all the fish in, and the fish are brought on to these little trucks, which are multicoloured trucks as well. They basically pour them into the back of the little truck, and it's not that smelly because it's brand new fresh, but you've got just all the colour of these boats, the trucks. There were kids playing cricket in front of the fish, and we ended up joining, playing the game of cricket with them. As soon as they heard we were from Australia, they wanted to play cricket with two Australians, and we were playing cricket with these boys who they spoke actually quite good English, and said their dad actually had one of the boats. He gave us a tour of the boat, and we had an absolute ball. And the other sort of things, again, I think about India that make it special is it's great to see some of the major sites, but Gujarat doesn't have those major sites, and some of the experiences are things like this. And the other things that I remember more is meeting the locals impromptu, and they'll be so generous in showing you around. They were so excited to hear that Australians were in their little village. They said they'd never had an Australian or had many people, tourists, and in fact they said, why are you here? But it was an absolutely beautiful little village. Again, the architecture was stunning, but it was the boats matched the colour as well. We then, on our fifth and final day, we went back up to Bhavnagar, so we headed north, and one last stop that I'd highly recommend if you're a wildlife fanatic as I am is called Velvadar Black Buck National Park. It's just north of Bhavnagar on the road to Ahmedabad, and we stayed in, I think, probably one of the nicest places I've ever stayed in my life, called Black Buck Lodge. And I mentioned the Asiatic Lion Lodge was nice, but this was another level. Absolutely beautiful. Not cheap. I haven't been to Africa, but I imagine it's like one of those upmarket African safari places where you're staying in these glamping tents. Mm-hmm. But it was absolutely stunning. You were right in the wildlife. There were wild jungle cats in the foliage. But the reason you go to Black Buck National Park is to see the beautiful black bucks. Black bucks, antelope with spiral horns. Mm-hmm. And look, there were thousands of them. And I remember Jeremy and I doing our safari, you get taken as part of your package in the tour. You get taken out with the national parks, and they take you out like they do with a lot of safaris in the evening and the morning. We did too. We saw that so many black bucks. We saw the Nilgai again, mm-hmm. the large antelope. But things that I never thought I'd be seeing in India, striped hyena, which I not the spotted ones that you see commonly in Africa, but the striped ones, which are rare in Africa. I think they're in Namibia, but they're also, I'm pretty sure they're the same species, but they were there, and we saw it catching and eating a black buck, which was amazing. And they're solitary animals, unlike hyena that you see in Africa, the spotted ones. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they survive there, because it is almost desert-like there. But they're very shaggy, they're very furry, and very pretty. My expectation of seeing hyena in the wild is they would be ugly, but these are quite beautiful creatures, other than their front legs, characteristically longer than their back legs.
Yeah,
but they're quite pretty, the spotted hyena. Got some beautiful photos, if you can call it beautiful, of them catching the black buck. The other thing that blew us away was the Indian wolves, and that was probably my favourite. The wolves were just absolutely beautiful, and we got some absolutely magical photos of the wolves just sitting right in front of us on the road and then running at full pelt at something they were trying to catch, and they were completely oblivious to us. So to see antelope, wolves, hyena all in one park is a pretty incredible experience. And it, like I said, people just looked at me like I was mad, but they are native. These are all native to this part of India, and the sightings are really common. That's the other thing about it. I've been lucky to see tigers in other parts of India, but some people go to India and don't see a tiger, and they might go on 6 or 7 safaris.
Right.
You're almost guaranteed to see lions in gear forest. You're almost guaranteed to see wolves and hyena and black bucks. I mean, black bucks are thousands of them in this park. And for birders, not that I've was particularly, but I know I'm getting older because I'm getting more and more interested in taking photos of birds, the bird life.
I did not know that that was a characteristic of getting older. Okay. I'll have to work on that.
But there was some beautiful bird life there. I think we saw 6 or 7 different types of raptors. There were lots of different storks. I'm not an expert in the names of the storks, but there were different storks. We also saw rollers, which are absolutely beautiful little coloured birds. Mm-hmm. Bee eaters too, again, with magical colours on them. So I would highly recommend it. Again, you would definitely be the only tourist going to this part, and it is a very unique national park compared to what you'll go and see in the more traditional parts where you look for tigers and leopards in the east of the country, which was absolutely magical too. But this is a very unique experience, and the accommodation, the food, the ambience of that lodge was just spectacular and was a great way to finish our short stay in Gujarat.
Excellent. Anything else we need to know about Gujarat before we get to some of our wrap-up questions, James?
The only thing I would say is, if you want a very unique experience that's nothing like the rest of India, it's a great place to go. But if you really, it's your first time in India, I think you still should tick off the big ticket items like the Taj Mahal and Delhi, going to see tigers. They are certainly magical experiences and I highly recommend it. But if you become like me, a bit of a Indian fanatic who loves the different cultures in each place and the different foods, this is unique, and I think it's more unique than any other part of India because you are simply going to be a rarity to see tourists. And as a result, it's something really special. So I think it's a great place to do if you like adventure, or it's a great place to do if you've been to India but you're looking for something very different that's still India but a different, complete different way of looking at India.
Excellent. You know what's coming. You're standing in the prettiest spot in Gujarat, at least the prettiest spot that you saw. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
For me, it was in the Gir forest where the lions were. And we stopped because you go there at sunset. You're in this beautiful teak woodland, hilly area. And we stopped to take some photos of the Nilgai, those giant antelope. And the sun was setting in the hills behind us, and Gujarat sunsets are quite well known. They're just absolutely spectacular. To see the sun setting over the hills with these herd of Nilgai just in the front of you with the colour, it was a special place. For me, that's probably one of my most lasting memories.
Excellent. And one thing that makes you laugh and say, only in Gujarat.
No alcohol? I think so. I think no alcohol and... one thing I will say is that did stand out is their language is completely different. We didn't leave many words, but we learned two sayings that made us instant. People who adored us if we said this. Whenever we met somebody, we learned to say Majama, which means how are you? And if they said it to us, we'd answer with Kemchop, which Kemchop means doing really great. If we said Kemchop like that, honestly, we'd have them laughing their heads off at us and just being absolutely adoring us, which was quite funny just to do it. In fact, we'd always say Majama to them. They'd ask us back and we'd say Kemchop. They are just very, very happy, friendly people. And I think for me, it was just fun and it's unique. The language is unique. That's the thing that stood out for me.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize Gujarat in just three words?
Color.
Okay.
Because there is simply so much colour with the wildlife and the saris and the colours of the homes in the Portuguese areas. Temples. There are so many magnificent temples. And I couldn't go past lions. If you're only going to see one thing in Gujarat, seeing the Asiatic lion is an amazing experience. They are beautiful animals. And it's very different to, say, the savannah you'll see in Africa. So lions, colour and temples.
Excellent. Our guest again has been James Schomburg. And James, we'll probably be back on next week talking about something else. That is not the plan. That is not the plan. It's just, but if it does happen, I won't apologize either. Thanks so much for coming back on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us. I know only part of your love for India. Your love for India came out in this episode, but we'll undoubtedly have you back on sometime talking about some other portion of India.
I'd love to one day, but thanks so much for telling me about Gujarat. It is a great experience, and thanks again for having me.
Thanks, as always, go out to the patrons of the show who help support Amateur Traveler financially. If you're interested in becoming a patron of the show and learning what that entails and what you get for that, go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. I heard from longtime listener Jim, who wrote about the episode we did on the Windjammer cruise in Maine, said, "Listen to this while walking this morning. My wife and I have taken 4 Windjammer cruises with a 5th planned for 2020, which didn't happen, and we planned for 2022. We sailed on a different boat, note these are boats, not ships, called American Eagle, 92 feet long, out of Rockland. The captain, John Foss, was a shipmate of mine in the Coast Guard. He used to own the Lewis R. French. The American Eagle has an engine, so she goes to some more distant itineraries than the French. She has a new captain beginning this year. The passengers help raise and lower the sails and help with meal distribution and cleanup. The lobster beak is, as your guest described it, but there's also pie made with wild Maine blueberries. The cabins are tight. Fresh water is precious, so if somebody takes a long shower every day, it runs out. Don't ask me how I know this. Most of the Maine coast is privately owned, and the only way you can see it is from a boat like this. You have to bring a good attitude, no high heels or golf shoes, and be flexible, physically and mentally. Thanks so much, Jim. The voting where the amateur traveler trip is going to go in 2022 seems to be wrapping up, and there is a favorite that is running ahead, and I'll let you go to amateurtraveler.com/trips to discover that. We'll give it one more week, and then we'll announce the trip. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com, and thanks so much for listening.